content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the January 16th, 2026 issue of the Week. And we are back with our first new issue of 2026. It's good to be back. I hope your year is off to a good start. The cover drawing this week has President Donald Trump. He is dressed in a military outfit like Napoleon Bonaparte. He's smiling. He's got his head tilted slightly to the side. He's got his right hand tucked in his vest. And in his left hand is a globe. We see the Western Hemisphere, and there are multiple American flags poked in it. Looks like Venezuela, of course, and maybe Colombia, Greenland. That looks like Cuba and maybe Mexico. The headline is Imperial Ambitions, an emboldened Trump eyes new targets after Venezuela. There are lots of stories about this, and I'll try not to overdo you, but we will start with the first main story. Trump claims control of Venezuela after U.S. raid. What happened? Confusion reigned in Venezuela this week after the U.S. toppled President Nicolas Maduro in a lightning military operation, with President Trump saying the U.S. would now run the country while the remaining leaders of the autocratic regime insisted they were in charge. Trump gave no details of how the nation of 28 million would be governed following an early morning raid that seized Maduro and brought him and his wife, Celia Flores, to New York City to stand trial on narco-terrorism charges. But Trump asserted, "We're going to run it, fix it." Elections, he said, would be held at the right time. Trump demanded total access to Venezuela's vast oil reserves and announced the interim government would give the U.S. up to 50 million barrels of oil. Revenues from its sale will be controlled by me, he said, and used to benefit the people of Venezuela and the United States. Secretary of State Marco Rubio contradicted Trump, saying the U.S. was not running Venezuela, but would instead keep a military quarantine in place to coerce the government. Maduro's vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, was sworn in as interim president and struck a defiant tone after the U.S. raid, which killed at least 80 people, including military personnel and civilians, according to Venezuelan officials. Rodriguez called it an atrocity and insisted Venezuela would not be a colony to any empire. After Trump warned she would pay a very big price if she doesn't do what's right, Rodriguez struck a more conciliatory note, calling for peace and dialogue. Exiled opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, winner of last year's Nobel Peace Prize, said she was ready to assume control and would win a popular vote in a landslide. But Trump said she lacked the country's respect and that it would be very tough for her to be the leader. World leaders and Democrats on Capitol Hill assailed Maduro's seizure. U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres called it illegal and a dangerous precedent. Representative Seth Moulton, Democrat from Massachusetts, said the reckless elective regime change operation was not authorized by Congress. Trump dismissed his critics as weak, stupid people and hinted at military action in Mexico, Cuba, and Colombia, and a U.S. takeover of Greenland. American dominance in the Western Hemisphere, he said, will never be questioned again. What the editorial said. Trump's attack on Venezuela was illegal and unwise, said the New York Times. Few will miss Maduro, a despot who rigged elections, tortured and killed dissidents, and immiserated his country since taking charge in 2013. But Trump has offered not even a fig leaf of legal authority for this act of war, nor a coherent rationale besides the ludicrous claim that Maduro ran a narco-terrorist regime. And if there's an overriding lesson of American foreign affairs in recent decades, it's that toppling even the most deplorable regime can make things worse. This military masterstroke was an act of hemispheric hygiene, said the Wall Street Journal. An ally of Russia, China, and Iran, Maduro spread mayhem far and wide. That justifies the action under international law, and the Constitution gives the president broad leeway to act to protect national security, allowing him to reasonably sidestep congressional approval. But the stakes are high for what comes next. Whether he owns up to it or not, Trump is now in the business of regime change that he'll have to make a success. What the columnist said. Under what authority can Trump attack a foreign country that has not threatened us, asked Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. Even if you grant the dubious proposition that it's within his constitutional power, Trump needed to go to Congress for prudential reasons, to make his case for why this serves America, set out clear goals, and offer a rational plan for achieving them. But it's not clear Trump actually has a plan, because if he did, there's no good reason why he'd remove Maduro but leave behind his anti-American Marxist regime. Trump may have been guided by a confidential CIA assessment, said Michael Wilner in the Los Angeles Times. It warned of a wider conflict requiring U.S. boots on the ground if he were to back Venezuela's democratic opposition. It judged that neither Machado nor Edmundo González Urrutia, the opposition candidate who rightfully won the 2024 election, would be able to command Venezuela's armed forces, which are controlled by Maduro loyalists. Trump tentative backing leaves Rodriguez walking a tightrope, said Joe Daniels in the Financial Times. The canny political operator must balance the need to assuage Trump with the need to placate domestic audiences. The real power in Venezuela is neither Trump nor Rodriguez, said Ryan Dubé in the Wall Street Journal. It's two men who command people with guns. That's Interior Minister Diosdado Cabello and Defense Minister Vladimir Padrino, who lead the police, military, and militias that kept Maduro in power with deadly crackdowns on dissent. For now, they are displaying unity with Rodriguez, but they represent a wild card for Trump's bet that the remnants of the regime will fall in line to avoid Maduro's fate. This is a sad moment for America, said Mona Shirin in The Bulwark. Not every U.S. military adventure has been noble, but no country has more often extended itself for good purposes around the globe. But our intervention in Venezuela has nothing to do with promoting democracy. It's about straight-up plunder. Trump is turning the U.S. into an outlaw nation that threatens neighbors, bullies allies, and kidnaps foreign leaders. Exactly the kind of country against which America used to defend others. And the controversy of the week continues in the same vein as the first main story. Venezuela, the Donroe Doctrine takes shape. President Trump used to offer only vague answers when asked to explain the U.S. military campaign against Venezuela, said The Economist in an editorial. He'd cite the need to stop drugs or to reclaim oil assets. Rarely, if ever, did he mention regime change. But after last week's stunning pre-dawn rain that captured President Nicolas Maduro, Trump laid out an extraordinary view of the use of American power, saying he would oppose American dominance over the entire Western Hemisphere. Under this muscular revival of the 1823 Monroe Doctrine, now the Donro Doctrine, all countries from Canada to Argentina will yield to Washington. Venezuela will sell oil on terms set by the U.S. Cuba's leftist regime will be replaced. Troops could be deployed against the cartels running Mexico, Trump said, while Colombian President Gustavo Petro will have to watch his ass. And Greenland, part of NATO ally Denmark, could be seized. This abrupt return to a spheres of influence model of geopolitics is a death blow to the law-based humanistic world order, said M. Gessen in the New York Times, and a gift for Russia and China. By declaring his right to invade and plunder America's neighbors, Trump has greenlit Chinese leader Xi Jinping to seize Taiwan and Russia's Vladimir Putin to take as much of Europe as he wants to bite off. Trump likes slapping his name on things, said Rich Lowry in National Review, but the Donro Doctrine just rearticulates a principle that has guided our foreign policy for 200 years. The 20th century alone was littered with examples of the U.S. using its military dominance to advance its interests in Latin America, from Teddy Roosevelt's grabby maneuvering to secure the territory for the Panama Canal, to the 1989 raid ordered by George H.W. Bush that captured Panama's Manuel Noriega. Trump's rhetoric is more blatantly self-interested than we're used to, but there is a long and sensible American tradition of our policing and controlling our own geographical backyard. Rhetoric matters, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark. Yes, at certain moments the U.S. has acted without regard for international law or respect for smaller nations' sovereignty. But if the American-led world order that emerged after World War II stands for anything, it's a belief in those moral precepts and in the system of international rules that was built upon them. That Trump justified the Maduro raid purely in terms of American self-interest and seems more interested in extracting loot than spreading democracy, confirms that we now live in a world, as Trump advisor Stephen Miller bragged to CNN this week, that is governed by strength, that is governed by force, that is governed by power. It was always going to end this way, said Nick Cottagio in The Dispatch. Some critics are wasting their breath on the hypocrisy of our supposedly isolationist president embracing overseas adventures. But expansion is baked into the cake of authoritarian movements, where the obsession with dominance always eventually requires demonstrations of greatness at other countries' expense. As its poll numbers slide, the Epstein scandal festers, and the midterms draw closer, the allure to Trump of more military conquest will only grow, said Edward Luce in the Financial Times, and few would be splashier or easier than seizing Greenland. Anyone who thinks Trump is merely trolling with his renewed fixation on Arctic real estate should go book a holiday in Caracas. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for product placement. After Nike sold out of a gray $260 sweatsuit within hours of President Trump sharing a photo online of a handcuffed and blindfolded Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro wearing the fleece-lined athletic gear during his transport to the U.S. It's a good week for productivity after President Trump unleashed a salvo of 89 social media posts between 12:45 a.m. and 1:40 a.m. on a Sunday night. Averaging one post every 37 seconds, Trump's fusillade touched on such topics as Somali daycare fraud, the stolen 2020 election, and Barack Obama's ineligibility to be President of the United States. It was a good week for prophecy. After a group of Peruvian shamans, given their annual New Year's predictions, said 2026 would see Trump overthrow Venezuela's Maduro, which he did just 3 days later. Ominously for Trump, the shamans also predicted the U.S. leader would soon fall seriously ill. But it was also a bad week for prophecy. after the arrest of a Thai man who, in his work as a street fortune teller, allegedly told a 19-year-old tourist that she would soon experience misfortune and lose a valuable possession, a prediction that came true when he stole her iPhone 13 Pro. It was a bad week for exceptionalism after a new survey revealed a sharp decrease in the percentage of Americans who believe they could, without weapons, defeat a grizzly bear in a physical confrontation. Only 2.75% of U.S. sports fans told pollsters they could outfight a grizzly, a significant drop from 6% in 2021. And it was a bad week for parenting after a Maryland couple used ChatGPT to name their newborn son. Without divulging the parents' own first names, Carroll Hospital announced that the name Hudson Oakley Winkler was generated and selected using ChatGPT and wished the Winklers well in their new family traditions. In other news, Trump administration freezes billions in blue state aid. In the wake of a major welfare fraud scandal in Minnesota, the Department of Health and Human Services this week said it is cutting off $10 billion in aid to five Democratic states, citing suspicions of widespread misuse without providing evidence. Minnesota, New York, California, Illinois, and Colorado would be excluded from the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, which offers cash support to households with children, and will lose almost $2.4 billion meant for child care for working parents and $870 million in grants that largely aided at-risk children. HHS said it had concerns that federal aid was being funneled to undocumented immigrants, but did not elaborate. New York Governor Kathy Hochul vowed to take legal action over the freeze, saying, "Our kids should not be political pawns in a fight that Donald Trump seems to have with blue state governors." The title of the briefing this week is Giving Up the Booze. Americans are drinking less than ever, and a growing share are teetotalers. What's behind the trend? What do the numbers show? That the U.S. is losing its taste for the hard stuff. In a recent Gallup survey, 54% of American adults say they consumed alcohol, the lowest level since the pollster began tracking drinking behavior in 1939. The share of drinkers has dropped steadily and sharply since 2022, when 67% admitted they at least occasionally imbibe beer, wine, or spirits, and those that do still drink are knocking back far less. Pure alcohol consumption per person fell 3% in 2024, the biggest drop since the Prohibition era a century ago, according to the research firm Bernstein. While Gen Z often grabs headlines for its sober, curious lifestyle, only 50% of Americans ages 18 to 34 say they drink. Drinking is down across all generations, with a share of active drinkers among 35 to 54-year-olds dropping 10 percentage points since 2023 to 56%, and 5 points among those 55 and over, also to 56%, and those numbers could keep falling. 40% of adults told pollster Ipsos that their New Year's resolution for 2026 was to drink less alcohol. Why are people turning away? It's partly an aftershock of the COVID era. The stress, isolation, and boredom of the pandemic led Americans to ramp up their drinking, especially at home. Beer, wine, and liquor store sales spiked by about $42 billion from March to September 2020, a 20% increase over the same period in 2019. and the share of Americans who reported consuming alcohol at levels defined as heavy drinking, at least 15 drinks a week for men and 8 for women, went from 5.1% in 2018 to 6.1% in 2020 and 6.3% in 2022. After those years of excess, it's understandable that many people wanted to get sober or curb their drinking, said Malcolm Purinton, a beer historian at Northeastern University. Pendulums do swing back and forth, he said, but a growing awareness of alcohol's health risks is also causing Americans to shun booze. What's happening? Experts say alcohol is going through a tobacco moment, a reference to the 1970s tipping point when the public became aware of smoking's links to cancer and cigarette sales started to plummet. A decade or so ago, there was this perception that a glass of red wine with dinner every night might actually help you live longer, said addiction specialist Dr. Scott Hadlin. But in recent years, research has revealed the dangers of even moderate drinking. In early 2025, then Surgeon General Vivek Murthy issued a landmark advisory warning that no level of alcohol consumption is safe, noting that women who have just one drink a day have a 19% risk of developing an alcohol-related cancer, and that men who do the same have an 11% risk. Such warnings seem to be resonating. For the first time, a majority of Americans, 53%, now say having one or two drinks a day is unhealthy, according to Gallup. Are other factors at play? There's some evidence that GLP-1 weight loss drugs such as Ozempic or Wegovy, which about 1 in 8 adults now take, may stifle the desire to drink. But for Gen Z, social factors are likely the biggest driver. Younger people who saw their parents pound drinks during the pandemic might be embracing sobriety as a way to rebel, said Purinton. They're expressing their individuality by saying, I'm not going to be inebriated. I'm going to have control because you all didn't. The fear of being photographed drunk and shamed on social media is also a powerful deterrent. But Atsushi Katsuki, CEO of Japanese brewer Asahi, believes the biggest reason for the drop in drinking among young people is that they socialize less in person. Gaming, video streaming, and social media, he said, are eating into alcohol's share of fun, enjoyment, and happiness. Is the alcohol industry hurting? It's being battered not only by the drop in drinking, but also by consumers' economic worries and the shock waves of President Trump's tariffs. As of October, shares of the world's top listed beer, wine, and spirits makers had lost a combined $830 billion in just over 4 years, a total loss in market value of nearly 50%. Jim Beam, America's largest bourbon maker, announced last month it will halt production at its flagship Kentucky facility for 1 year. And it's not just the giants who are struggling. In 2024 and 25, there were more closures than openings of small breweries, a stark reversal for the two-decade-old craft beer boom. Winemakers face similar troubles. John Belletto, owner of Belletto Vineyards in Sonoma, California, said he expects his 2025 losses to hit $3 million, and that 30% of his grapes went unsold last year for the first time in a quarter century. Few industry insiders expect to turn around anytime soon. Instead, they are looking to adapt. How are they doing that? By embracing alcohol-free beer, wine, and mocktails. Annual sales of non-alcoholic NA beverages hit $1 billion in 2025, with NA beer sales rocketing by 22% from 2023 to 2024. Drinks giants are especially focused on crafting high-quality NA versions of their biggest brews, a tricky scientific task because ethanol is key to any beer's taste. UK-based Diageo has invested more than $70 million in Guinness Zero production since the alcohol-free stout launched globally in 2021. The NA beer made up more than half of the Guinness brand's growth in the U.S. in 2024. Other firms are selling functional drinks infused with supposedly mood-altering CBD oil, mushrooms, or botanicals. But analysts don't know if consumers will embrace such options en masse. And some speculate that Americans may eventually rediscover their taste for alcohol. Andrew Gowan, head of research for Bell Asset Management, said this uncertainty is why his investment firm is avoiding the alcohol sector for now. This industry has been around for 7,000 years, he said, but a lot can change. We'll read a few of the best columns. First up, free speech for me, not for thee. Government censorship has arrived in the U.S., said Adam Serwer, and it's being carried out by yesterday's free speech champions. The most vivid example of this hypocrisy is Barry Weiss, who was recently installed at the head of CBS News by Paramount's new owner, the pro-Trump billionaire David Ellison. Weiss rose to prominence as a writer who challenged the cancel culture of the illiberal left, but in her new role, she's gatekeeping on behalf of right-wing interests and Trump himself. She recently spiked a 60 Minutes report on CECOT, the brutal El Salvador prison where the Trump administration has sent hundreds of migrants to be tortured. It was a story the Trump administration and Ellison did not want to air, so Weiss claimed the story needed more balance. Weiss once insisted that nasty tweets from progressives were a harbinger of incipient totalitarianism. But now that an authoritarian president is using state power to punish news organizations and dictate what universities can teach and what museums can show about history, her outrage has vanished. To Weiss, free speech meant whatever conservatives want to say and did not include the right of others to talk back. A reminder of Trump's January 6 crimes. When House Republicans summoned former special prosecutor Jack Smith to defend his aborted prosecution of Donald Trump last month, said Austin Surratt, he made them look foolish. His testimony was such a disaster for Trump, in fact, that the House Judiciary Committee released the transcript on New Year's Eve, hoping no one would pay attention. Nonetheless, Smith provided a compelling refresher course on the crimes Trump committed while trying to hold on to power after losing the 2020 election, as well as the cavalier way he dealt with the sensitive national security information after leaving the White House. Smith methodically laid out the evidence that Trump broke numerous laws in his attempted coup and his theft of classified documents, and said he believed we had proof beyond a reasonable doubt in both cases. He said the most powerful evidence came from Republicans who put country before party, including former Vice President Mike Pence and several fake electors who later realized they were being used to overturn a fair election. Smith's testimony left little doubt that had Trump gone to trial, he would not be in the Oval Office today and might be in prison. This column comes from France. We were ascendant in Bardot's day. Brigitte Bardot was an emblem of a bygone France, said Thomas Legrand. The film star, who died last week at age 91, personified the 30 glorious years, that era from the end of World War II through the mid-1970s, when a radiant, vibrant, and powerful France showed the traumatized world how to emerge resplendent from the horrors of war. Back then, France represented the future. With its rapid economic growth, it was the driving force of a Europe that was not yet united. Everyone then saw us as they saw Bardot, through Hollywood's eyes. Charming, chic, artistic, refined, free-spirited, and full of life. With her insolent beauty, she shed old taboos, helping to create a culture where one could laugh at anything, flirt, drive fast, smoke in the hospital, and drink wine in the school cafeteria. Alas, it was all over too soon. Bardot eventually showed us the prejudices prevalent at that time as she began spouting anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant rhetoric. Now her latter year's attitude of things were better before is spreading as more French people turn to nationalism and the National Rally Party. They forget that in Bardot's heyday, women weren't allowed to have checkbooks in their own names, and French colonial forces were torturing Algerian resistance fighters. That bygone France looks amazing in photos, but I'll take the France of today. Time for the last word, our feature article, Line in the Sand. Saudi Arabia's crown prince wanted to build a linear city stretching 100 miles across the desert, said Allison Killing in the Financial Times, but he couldn't overcome the laws of physics and finance. The centerpiece of the line, a vast glass-clad linear city in Saudi Arabia, was to be the Hidden Marina. The world's largest cruise ships would glide through a 1,000-foot-high gate over a deep-water harbor carved from the desert. Suspended above it, like a chandelier, a 30-story glass and steel building would hang from the arch, a sci-fi vision dreamed up by a Hollywood art director. Even its designers warned that physics might not cooperate. But the marina, engineers planned a high-speed rail station. Beneath the marina, engineers planned a high-speed rail station. Above the chandelier, another flourish, a 45,000-seat soccer stadium perched 1,150 feet above sea level, ready for Saudi Arabia's 2034 World Cup. This stadium will be like nothing you have ever seen, Dennis Hickey, the line's chief development officer, told an audience in Davos earlier this year. Everyone says, can you build it? His own team was unsure of the answer. As architects worked through the plans, the chandelier began to seem implausible. One recalled warning Tarek Kadoumi, the line's executive director, of the difficulty of suspending a 30-story building upside down from a bridge hundreds of meters in the air. You do realize the earth is spinning, and that tall towers sway, he said. The chandelier, the architect explained, could start to move like a pendulum, then pick up speed and eventually break off, crashing into the marina below. Kadoumi listened, and the work continued. Yet with an upside-down building, even simple things become complex. When you flush the toilet, the stuff goes downhill, right? The architect asked. We've worked that out, Kadoumi replied. According to the architect, we're going to have hundreds of shuttle cars running back and forth, picking up the sewage on retractable bridges. Such was the gravity-defying spirit of NEOM, the vast mega-project with the line at its heart, that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman hoped would redefine life in the kingdom and beyond. The chandelier was just one part of the line, a 1,640-foot-tall mirror glass structure running more than 100 miles across the sand and designed to house 9 million people, a city built into a wall higher than the Empire State Building. When construction began 3 years ago, the line was meant to be a symbol of unstoppable momentum, transformative urban living without traditional streets or cars, powered by renewables, running uninterrupted from the Gulf of Aqaba to the Hejaz Mountains. It would be a centerpiece of Neom, the futuristic metropolis through which Prince Mohammed intended to prove the scale of his ambition as Saudi Arabia aims to transition from oil to a digital economy. But as the designs advanced, his dream collided with reality. Prince Mohammed consolidated his position as Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler in 2017, becoming heir apparent at just 31 in what critics described as a palace coup. He was already spearheading sweeping, if not autocratic, plans to modernize the Gulf state and wean it from its addiction to oil. Neom, launched months after he became crown prince, was a testament to that vision, a vast desert complex encompassing the line, the desert ski resort Trojena, a luxury coastal development, an industrial zone, and a subterranean digitalized community of the future. The idea for the linear city came from the prince himself. The original proposal, developed by Los Angeles architecture firm Morphosis, envisaged a 2-kilometer-wide, 1.2-mile strip of settlements running from the sea to the mountains and connected by rail, a relatively traditional urban plan. But in late 2020, Prince Mohammed issued new instructions. I told the team, how about if we take that 2 kilometers and we flip it to 2 towers, he explained in a Discovery documentary. As he spoke, he folded his hands together as if closing a book. The guidance went beyond setting the line's width at 650 feet. I want it contiguous and I want it mirrored, MBS told his staff, according to someone involved in the planning. With its roof at a constant 1640 feet above sea level, the line would rank among the world's tallest buildings. But unlike most skyscrapers, it would be occupied to its summit, a continuous wall of glass and steel. The concept for the line was unveiled in 2021, and gradually the hiring began. Thousands of architects, engineers, construction managers, designers, and others took up roles with Neom. Nothing like this had ever been tried before, and some of the team sounded as if their main obstacle was conventional thinking. I was in a conversation one day with two physicists, quantum physicist Antoni Vivas, then Neom's chief urban development officer, told Discovery. One of them looks at the other and looks at me and says, "You know what? Perhaps it's the time of the poets now. We need poets." Master planners coordinated 75 teams of architects designing the individual neighborhoods of the line. Each one was supposed to be distinctive. The proposal even included a 1,640-foot-tall royal palace. "It's got hospitals, it's got universities, it is a full-blown city," said Hickey at Davos. The vertical stacking would mean residents could find everything within 5 minutes. A light rail system inside the line's primary deck would stop every tenth of a mile. On top, there would be buses and driverless pods, as well as the pedestrian boulevards. Grand sweeping staircases would link generous public spaces. "You could create some absolutely spectacular vistas," said Oliver Prahn, the Hollywood art director who produced the concept design for the Hidden Marina. But natural light was a problem. Most public spaces were located near the middle of the building, which lacked daylight, said a designer who worked on the detailed design of the neighborhoods. The stadium, which would span the full width of the line, also cast an immense shadow over other sections. Gardens were an antidote to high-density living. However, they had to be concentrated in just one blade of the building, facing the canyon. The rest of the structure lacked the necessary sun. Many other things in the line had to be rethought from scratch. Water and sewage, mail delivery, insurance systems, and rubbish removal became unique challenges in a vertical city. Fire safety required a complete rethink. Rather than down and out, residents would move sideways to buildings on the left or right in the event of an emergency. James Midling of engineering firm Mott MacDonald, the city infrastructure engineer for the project, compared working on the line to developing the light bulb, which had revolutionized how people live. These opportunities are presented daily on the line, he told the Cityscape Global event in Riyadh in 2024, and at times it's having that ambition and bravery. Some design challenges could not be resolved. The line would block the migration routes through the mountains for several species of mammal. It also crosses a migratory route used by millions of birds flying south from Europe and Asia to overwinter in Africa, including endangered species such as the greater spotted eagle and European turtle dove. A planned wind farm north of the line added to worries. If the birds aren't being sliced and diced by going through wind turbines, they are going to run into a 500-meter-high mirrored finish, said the planner. We would sit in hundreds, literally hundreds of meetings about birds, said the senior architect. Designers proposed fritting, printing small ceramic dots on the glass to make it more visible to the birds. But Livia Ray of the Swiss Ornithological Institute explained that this would not address the issue. Even if they spotted the obstacle, they would have to fly 55 miles along the line to go around it. To meet the 2030 deadline, construction work needed to start quickly. Piling began in the spring of 2022, even though detailed design for the actual building had not yet been done. To cope with the uncertainty, the design team maximized the size, making the piles 8 to 10 feet in diameter. Some of these piles are the biggest in the world. They're absolutely colossal, said a construction specialist who worked on the line. On site, piling rigs worked around the clock, putting in 60 to 65 piles a day. About 6,000 of them were drilled into the ground, stretching across 1.2 miles of desert. The foundation work cost several billion dollars. I clearly only did what I thought was sensible, said the senior construction manager. But even as this work was being done, plans for the line were being scaled back. NEOM's owner, the Public Investment Fund, the near $1 trillion sovereign wealth fund chaired by Prince Mohammed and tasked with spearheading his development plans, was coming under increasing pressure to deliver returns after a years-long spending splurge. In tandem, a mood of realism was taking hold in Riyadh as the government sought to manage its resources as oil prices softened, leading to reprioritization of its and the PIF's vast financial commitments. Executives raised myriad questions with management. From the outset, we did a fair amount of warnings to make sure that leadership, especially at the board level, were aware of these risks, said the senior executive. Where would the 9 million people due to populate the line come from? How quickly could they reasonably be expected to arrive? Could construction and manufacturing start quickly enough? Would the levels of imports required overheat the economy? What if oil prices sank, drying up Saudi Arabia's key source of revenue? What if the necessary materials could not be found? And did the Gulf nation really have the scientific and technical expertise to execute such a vast scheme? Yet the pressure to deliver was relentless. The board expected the chief executive to move things very quickly, said the senior executive. Dates had been given to the Crown Prince about what was achievable, but without the detail of knowing how it could be done, said the senior design manager. When those dates were made public, they would be a loss of face if they weren't met. That's where tensions grew. The line, or at least its beginnings, can already be seen from space. Satellite imagery shows excavation and tunneling work for the railway system, the spine connecting the line to NEOM International Airport, stretching for 93 miles from the coast into the Hejaz Mountains. In a valley between two mountain ranges, leveling work is evident for airport and its runways. In true NEOM fashion, there's a mountain at the end of the runway that had to be blown up, said the senior architect. Construction work has now stopped on both the spine and the airport. No new target for the airport has been set. The foundations for the line's first modules, perhaps the largest piles ever laid by man, are also visible, waiting to support the world's largest occupied building, if it ever arrives. The village of Kayal, which was a few miles from the hidden marina, has been razed. 15 members of the Huaytay tribe, who protested against their eviction, were sent to prison, some for up to 50 years, and three others were sentenced to death, according to human rights observers. At the marina, excavations by late last year had dug out 100 million cubic meters of soil, the equivalent of 40 Great Pyramids of Giza. Ships will access it via a canal leading more than a half mile inland from the coast. The chandelier, the upside-down office building hanging from the giant arch above the marina, remains in the plans, but NEOM no longer intends to base its headquarters there. With a goal now to build just three of the 20 modules originally planned, the ambition for the line's first phase is a faint echo of what it once was. One person familiar with the project said work had effectively stopped, with efforts now focused on completing a few small buildings around the marina. Some of the earlier piling work has been covered with sand. "I think as a thought experiment, great," said one urban planning expert who works in Saudi Arabia, "but don't build thought experiments." This was adapted from a story originally published in the Financial Times. I read a business column this week. Buffett, the end of a golden era for Berkshire Hathaway. "The investing world's North Star is officially a retiree," said Yun Lee in CNBC.com. December 31st marked Warren Buffett's last day as the chief executive of Berkshire Hathaway, capping off a 60-year tenure that saw him transform an obscure New England textile mill into one of the most powerful compounding engines in market history. Buffett, 95, will remain the firm's chairman, but he hands the reins to successor Greg Abel, leaving Wall Street grappling with how singular his reign has been. The numbers speak for themselves. Between 1965, when Buffett took over, and the end of 2024, Berkshire's shares rose 5.5 million percent, trouncing the broader market and turning ordinary investments into fortunes. Buffett's secret was an unusually spare formula. Use insurance float as a source of low-cost capital, buy businesses with durable cash flows, and allow time to do most of the work. It produced long-held stakes in blue-chip companies like Coca-Cola and American Express, and the capacity to amass a remarkable portfolio of U.S. staples, from the insurance company Geico and BNSF Railway to See's Candies and Benjamin Moore Paints. "It's hard to imagine a tougher act to follow," said the economist. Berkshire has mostly been known as a vessel for Buffett's investing genius, which has proved wildly successful for its shareholders. But Abel, who ran Berkshire's non-insurance operations, is not a stock picker, and one of Buffett's top investment lieutenants, Todd Combs, recently left for J.P. Morgan Chase. Abel's talents as an investor will soon be put to test. "Berkshire enters the Abel era with more questions than answers," said Eric Platt in the Financial Times. "The new CEO has only seldom made himself available to the press and investors. Abel has signaled the company's investment philosophy will not change, but Berkshire's recent purchase of a $4.3 billion stake in Google parent Alphabet in December raises the question, was Abel involved? If so, it would signal he is open to making big bets on fast-growing technology companies. The most pressing question for Abel," said Crystal Herr in the Wall Street Journal, "is what to do with $358 billion in cash. Buffett has long prided itself on having an ironclad balance sheet with plenty saved up for a rainy day. Berkshire's piggy bank, however, has enough to buy Home Depot outright, with a few billion to spare. The risk to holding that much cash is that the return Berkshire can receive on such holdings could fall as the Federal Reserve lowers interest rates. But investors say they don't expect Able to make any big investments until stock prices come down. What's the key to Buffett's success? Asked biographer Roger Lowenstein in the Boston Globe. I believe it is his character. Wall Street is full of intelligent and ambitious people, but few have displayed Buffett's unswerving integrity and dedication to principle. That's the biggest void left upon his retirement, said Seth A. Klarman in The Atlantic. He exits at a time when many of the most successful people in the business community seem single-mindedly focused on making money rather than doing the right thing for the business and its shareholders. In a world alarmingly short of proper role models, Buffett's leadership will be deeply missed. And we have time for one of the Talking Points articles. Minnesota fraud, Waltz takes the hit. It isn't often that politicians pay a price for the failures of government, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. But in a rare and welcome exception, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz announced this week he would not seek re-election as a result of the state's billion-dollar welfare fraud scandal. For months, Walz shrugged off the ripoff of taxpayer funds as a regrettable consequence of Minnesota's generous Scandinavian-style safety net. But outrage grew as more than 90, mostly Somali defendants, were charged with participating in schemes to defraud the state and federal governments of funds meant for food aid, child care, housing assistance, and other benefits. Federal prosecutors estimated the total price tag topped $9 billion, a sum Walz disputes. In saying he was dropping out of the 2026 race, Walz blamed both the criminals who prey on our generosity and the cynics who prey on our differences. How about taking some personal responsibility? The fraud scandal is real, but it's being dishonestly exploited and exaggerated by the MAGA right, said Zoe Sotil and Andy Rose in CNN.com. In a recent viral video, 23-year-old conservative influencer Nick Shirley claimed with little evidence that Somali-run daycares were raking in public money even though they had zero children in their care. In response, President Trump announced a pause of federal funding of Minnesota child care, and at least one Somali-run daycare in Minnesota was vandalized. Self-styled investigators have tried to barge into child care centers in other states with Somali-American populations, using their locked doors as evidence that they are committing fraud. Fraudsters should go to prison, said Sal Rodriguez in the Orange County Register. But the Minnesota scheme, which was first discovered and prosecuted during the Biden administration, has become an opportunity for MAGA World to demonize all 260,000 Somali Americans as pirates and garbage. That's nothing more than racist demagoguery. Indisputably, the government gets defrauded too often, said Noah Smith in his Substack newsletter. Recent examples include a $1.3 billion Medicare scheme perpetrated by a Chicago executive, Philip S. Formes, pardoned by Trump during his first term. This past year, Trump gave clemency and exemption from financial penalties to 20 convicted criminals, none of them Somalis, and denied fraud victims tens of millions of dollars in promised restitution. Fraud damages trust in American institutions, but don't expect a coherent response from the most corrupt administration in American history. And a few of the short notes. President Trump takes 325 milligrams of aspirin a day, according to his physician, Navy Captain Sean Barbarella, four times the dose doctors recommend for cardiovascular disease prevention. They'd rather have me take the smaller one, Trump, 79, said of his doctors. They say aspirin is good for thinning out the blood, and I don't want thick blood. The number of Indian students arriving in the U.S. to study at colleges and universities dropped 44% last year to about 41,000 as the Trump administration cracked down on immigration. As of 2025, Indians were the largest contingent of foreign students at U.S. universities, accounting for nearly one in three international students. Russia seized control last year of an extra 1,864 square miles of Ukrainian land, about 0.8% of the country's territory, at the cost of almost 420,000 dead and wounded Russian troops, according to the Ukrainian military. Hours before the U.S. captured Venezuela's president, a newly created account on Polymarket wagered $32,537 that Nicolas Maduro would be out of power by the end of January. The bet turned a profit of over $408,000 and raised concerns of possible insider trading. The poll watch, 68% of Americans believe 2026 will be an economically difficult year. 59% think consumer prices will rise at a high rate. And 62% believe unemployment will increase. And we'll close with a quote from Frederick Douglass, who says, "It is easier to build strong children than to repair broken men." With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.